You're listening to the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of Job. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in the book of Job, chapters 1 through 3.
When a man is down, isn't it so good to know that he's got a wife that he can count on for love and support and encouragement? But look at what Mrs. Job, the man's own wife, says to him in verse 9. Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Man, curse God and die. You can just feel the love, can't you? This is why Satan didn't kill Job's wife along with his kids. She was more of a help to him alive than dead. I mean, Mrs. Job just says, man, just throw in the towel and give me the life insurance, would you? Let me just pause for a minute. I hope you ladies, you married ladies, understand how important you are to your husband. Never underestimate, ladies, the impact that your words have on your husband. Your words will either build him up or they will tear him down. And they'll do so in ways that you will never know. You know, some wives are constantly belittling their husbands, complaining that he's not more of a man. The problem is they're blind to the correlation. That maybe their words are what's keeping him from being the man that she desires. Hey, a husband, above all else, he needs encouragement from his wife. Mrs. Job should have learned that. Verse 10, but Job said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? And shall we not accept adversity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Wow! What a strong faith. What an amazing faith. Job loses his fortune, his family, his fitness, his friends. He loses everything but his faith. You know, whenever I study the book of Job, I'm struck by an often overlooked fact. Job never read the first two chapters of the book of Job. Think about that. Job never read the first two chapters of the book of Job. Job never learned the reason for his calamity. You and I are informed why Job suffered, but not Job. God never told Job the reason for his agony. But oh my, that doesn't stop his friends from offering their opinions. And this is what happens for the next 35 chapters. His friends wade in, and they begin to tell him why all this happened to him. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Notice with Job, these three friends made a foursome. I figure they were golfing buddies. They had a foursome that met every Saturday morning, you know, and when Job didn't show up one weekend, they knew that something was wrong. The author mentions their names: Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And Zophar, it's okay, but when he and his friends begin to open their mouths, believe me, they torture poor Job with erroneous counsel. And let me go ahead and get this out of the way up front. Up until now, the shortest man in the Bible has been Nehemiah. You know that. But now we have a man even shorter, Bildad the Shuhite. So there's Nehemiah, and then there's Bildad the Shuhite. A couple of little guys, short guys in the Bible. And you know, there's also some evidence here that the Shuhite's daughter had been recently married. For catch his first name? Bildad. You know, just Bildad. Got it. Maybe I'm the only one that finds that funny, but Bildad the Shuhite. Now here's one of the most comical lines in all 42 chapters. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. Put comfort him in italics, because Job's buddies do anything but comfort him. You've heard the old expression, with friends like these, who needs enemies? Job's comforters are more his tormentors, and they will accuse him falsely. They will be unmerciful. They will even make up stuff. They'll tell lies about Job. They're going to do all they can to pin a sin on Job. You see, these three men try to prove that Job's sin is the cause of his calamity, that it had to be something Job did to deserve all that befell him. The bulk of this book consists of three rounds of dialogue. What happens next is that Eliphaz will speak, and then Job will respond, and then Bildad accuses Job, and then Job will answer, and then Zophar will condemn him, and then Job will offer a defense. And this cycle occurs three times throughout the book. I think you'll kind of notice that Eliphaz will be more diplomatic than the other two. Bildad will be noted for his bluntness, and Zophar will get downright rude. It's been said, pick your friends, but not to pieces. That would have been good advice for Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. I call them the three musketeers of misery. Verse 12, and when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him. Notice, they'd always seen Job on the top of the world. Now his pitiful condition sends them into a shock. They lifted up their voices and they wept, and each one tore his robe, a sign of grief, and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. And so they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. In that day, 7 days and seven nights was the period of mourning for a person who had died. I mean, in their minds, Job was dead. Their friends were just attending a funeral. And no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. I mean, to their credit, this was really the only good thing that they did, is they withheld their words. I mean, no one spoke to him. You know, this is a good approach to someone who is a sufferer. Sometimes the best way to help someone in pain or someone who's grieving is to just be there. You know, we go rushing in thinking we've got to say something. Sometimes that's not necessary. Just your presence is important. Sometimes our words of wisdom in a moment of crisis can come off glib or trite. That's why we need to wait until the time is right. Then we can speak. Our counsel can be misunderstood in those moments of grief, but our presence will always speak powerfully of our love. As a Christian, you need to know that God hasn't promised everyone a bed of roses. I hope you know that. There will be rainy days in every life. It was C.S. Lewis who once quipped, "Why should the righteous suffer? Why not? Only the righteous can handle it." Everyone who lives in this fallen world is going to experience some pain in their life. Everyone. You see, a Christian's advantage is not that they're immune from suffering. The Christian's advantage is that God has promised to go with them through that suffering and to reveal himself in that suffering. And this is why it's wrong to conclude that just because a person suffers, it means that they've sinned. And just because all is well, it means that they're righteous. You know, it's ironic, but often golfing buddies are the ones who make this mistake perhaps more than anyone else. I've played golf before. Somebody hits an errant shot, it goes off into the woods. It hits a tree and caroms off the tree and rolls right back into the middle of the fairway. And you know what they'll say? The one guy will look to the guy who hit the ball and he said, "Oh my, looks like you're living right." As if holy living entitles you to favorable breaks, while unholy living leaves you in the rough. Hey, I wish life was always that straightforward, but it's not. Guys, this is false theology. And yet, sadly, it's the theology of 90% of the people I know. Bad things happen to bad people. Good things happen to good people. Thus, when bad stuff happens, I draw one of two conclusions. Either I've sinned or God failed. Many a person's faith has been shipwrecked by this kind of false theology. This is a simplistic, erroneous theology, and it's lethal to a person's faith. This kind of theology backs you into a corner. When setbacks occur, either God failed or you're a failure. And most of us aren't going to accuse God, so what do? We beat ourselves up. Here's the message of Job. There could be a reason hidden from view. Only heaven knows the whole story. Hardship, difficulty, doesn't mean that God has failed, nor does it mean that you have sinned. Only heaven knows the whole story. Faith doesn't always get a reason. You see, real faith trusts God even when it can't trace Him. It's not faith from the driver's seat behind the steering wheel. It's not even faith from the back seat where you can still see out the window. Faith begins when you're locked up in the trunk, blind to what's happening, and yet you still believe that God is going to take you in the right direction. That's real faith. That was the faith of Job. Job doesn't see. He doesn't know. He knows there's another reason. He just doesn't know what it is. And trying to discover that reason, trying to answer this question why, becomes the driving passion of his life. Job's friends have been sitting quietly with him now for 7 days. Finally, Job breaks the silence. Chapter 3. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. It seems that the pain of his boils and the trauma of his loss have now settled in. Job maintains his faith, and he will throughout the book, but pain begins to bore its way into his psyche. I mean, never underestimate the suffering that this man endured. And Job spoke and said, "May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived. May that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it." Job regrets being born. He wished he had never lived than to live and lose so much. "May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, may darkness seize it. May it not rejoice among the days of the year. May it not come into the number of months." His date of birth should be blotted off the calendar, forever forgotten. "Oh, may that night be barren. May no joyful shout come into it. May those curse it who curse the day, those who are ready to arouse Leviathan." Now, the word Leviathan means twisting serpent. There was a literal Leviathan that we'll discover later, a physical animal. It's mentioned in the latter part of the book and used as an example of the raw power of nature, the explosiveness of nature. Leviathan was a sea serpent, perhaps even a dragon. But spiritually speaking, throughout the Bible, Leviathan is associated with Satan. Satan, too, appeared as a serpent to Eve in the garden. The devil is the twisting, tricky serpent of old, the Leviathan, the author of confusion. And here Job calls on the sorcerers, the magicians, the evil people that practice the black magic, that dabble in the occult, that conjure up Satan. He calls on them to curse the day of his birth. He says, "May the stars of its morning be dark. May it look for light, but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes." Our friend Job's a little depressed here, isn't he? "Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb?" I mean, he wishes he was stillborn. It would have been better if he had just died at birth. "Why did the knees receive me?" In other words, why was I born? "Why the breast that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw light?" Job is so full of pain that he sees death as an escape, that if he just died, it would be a welcomed relief. "There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor. The small and the greater there, and the servant is free from his master." Now, I want you to understand something important. The Bible is the Word of God. But the Bible is not always the words of God. You following me? The Bible is the Word of God, but it's not always the words of God. Someone asks, is every single word in the Bible true? Well, it's a true record of what was said. But what if what's said is not true? And here's a good example of that. Job is not accurate here. He's making statements that are not true. Job is speaking out of his pain rather than out of the truth. After death, the wicked don't cease from troubling. They may escape an earthly trial, but hey, trust me, a far greater trouble awaits the wicked in the afterlife. Pain has a terrible impact on a person's theology. Understand that. A hurting person will think things and make statements about God and life and people that are simply not true. And often the Bible records them. This occurs in the Psalms, in fact. There are a lot of Psalms where people are just speaking out of their pain, venting their frustrations, not necessarily speaking the truths of God. The Bible records these erroneous statements as the true record of what was said. God knows that we can learn from the struggles of even spiritually ignorant folks who are trying to grapple with the truth and trying to accurately understand God's plan. So here's a good rule of hermeneutics or of Bible interpretation. It's to recognize who is speaking and the condition of their soul when they speak. See, it's dangerous to draw doctrine from the words of Job. And yet, sadly, many people have done so. Groups like the Seventh-day Adventist, they've read Job's comments here about death, and they've taken his words to teach what they call soul sleep. That when a person dies, he or she doesn't go to heaven, but remains asleep in the grave, awaiting the resurrection. Obviously, the New Testament teaches us otherwise. The Apostle Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 8, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Yes, death may be an escape from a trial on earth, but for the wicked, a greater trial is before them once they enter the afterlife. Here's why it's unwise to develop doctrines from the statements of Job. When God finally comes to Job at the end of the book, it's interesting the first thing God says to him. He asks, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That's a fancy way of saying, who's this guy I've been having to listen to who doesn't know what he's talking about? In other words, this Job has been more a dark cloud than a ray of light. God is saying that if you've listened to Job, you are really confused. So, you understand? Good rule of Bible interpretation. The Bible is the Word of God, but it's not always the words of God. Remember that. Verse 20. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul who long for death? But it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Again, Job regrets he was born. He wishes he was still born. Now he still wants to die. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? Here's Job's most perplexing problem. Seven times in chapter 3, Job uses the biggest three-letter word in the English language, and you know what it is? It's why. Why? If he just knew why. Job calls himself a man whose way is hidden. See, for 7 days he's been sitting there. And while he's been scratching his pustulous sores, he's been trying to figure out why God has allowed this calamity in his life. He never read the first two chapters of the book of Job. And he's sitting there and he's thinking, there's got to be a reason. There's got to be a purpose. I just don't see it. And again, discovering why, trying to make sense of his mess, becomes the burning issue in Job's life. You know, without question, Job's greatest grief was not caused by his material losses. or by even the boils on his body. Job's most excruciating pain was not knowing why. Is this just me or does it apply to you as well? You know, I can endure certain things if I just know why. I hate shots. When I go into the doctor and I have to have a shot, man, I freak out. But if I'm told the reason for that shot, I tend to rise to the occasion. You know, I can endure it, maybe get through it. But what if I walk in and they tell me they're going to give me a shot and I ask why and they won't tell me? I'm going to get mad. I'm going to pound my fist down on the counter and I'm going to demand to know why. And that's what happens to Job. He begins to demand to know why. Don Baker writes, all Job wanted was an explanation. Even the severest pain becomes somewhat tolerable with knowledge. Guys, the best pain reliever by far is not Advil or Percodan or morphine. It's an explanation. If there's a good purpose for our pain, we tend to rise to the occasion. But how do we respond when we get no reason why? This becomes the issue in Job. How do we deal with the sovereignty of God? Job sums up his feelings here in verse 24. For my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes. Now, what was it that Job dreaded? Remember chapter 1. Job offered sacrifices for his children just in case they sinned. I mean, the worst nightmare for Job was to fall out of God's favor. And now this appears to have happened. Why has God turned against me? Of course, we know that just the opposite was true. God loved Job. In fact, Job was God's pride and joy. That was the reason that set off this whole ordeal in the first place. And yet at the moment, Job doesn't see it. You know, it's a credit to this man's character that his standing before God was even more important to him than his own health or his own wealth. One final point here in verse 25, Job confesses, "For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me." You know, there are some word faith teachers, Joyce Myers and Benny Hinn, and Eddie Long, who suggest that Job's suffering was a result of some negative confession that he had made. And they teach the false notion that you can create your own reality by the words that you speak. Job feared suffering, and he verbalized his fears, and it resulted in his calamity. For this thing that I greatly feared has come upon me. Hey, this is hogwash. I hope you know that. Revelation 2, verse 10 tells us that remember back to Job 2, verse 10. Remember back to the verse there? You can flip back over. Check this out. I think God put it there just for these kinds of false teachers. Job 2, verse 10 says, in all this, Job did not sin. How? With his lips. I like that. I believe that was put there deliberately just to shoot down these false teachings. There was nothing that Job said. There was no false confession that he made that produced this calamity. Now, it's interesting. The Jewish Talmud teaches that you don't speak at a funeral until the mourner speaks first. And so Job's words in chapter 3 become permission for his friends to speak up. And that's what we find in chapter 4. And that's where we'll begin next week.
Did you know that God's aware of what you're doing each day? We know this because of the book of Job. God noticed Job's life and comments to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil." God was aware of Job's honor and devotion to him and knew that Job would continue in that way no matter what happened. God has noticed you as well. Every loving gesture you make toward another human being, every moment you spend in the Bible, God sees. He does see the problems too. God knows we're drawn to sin. Even though we do our best most of the time, we all fail. God provided a solution though. He sent His Son to take our punishment for every sin we'll ever commit. We can live secure in the knowledge that if we've accepted this gift of grace, our faults no longer separate us from God. We're free to live for Him and share His incredible love and truth with the world around us. Thanks for tuning in to Sandy Adams Radio. We hope you've been encouraged by what you've heard. We'd love for you to visit our website, sandyadams.org. There you'll find more teachings by Pastor Sandy, resources to help you study the Bible, and a link to our mobile app. That's all at sandyadams.org. And that's all for today. But be sure to join us again for another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.